On this episode of Entertainment Education, the podcast, the one with video games, grab your friends and let's challenge them to a Super Smash Bros. Contest. We grab our controllers and discuss how video games can be an effective teaching method. There are so many elementary schools now that are using video games to teach subjects like math, and the world is only opening up and leveling up from there. Joining me this episode as my player 2 and 3 are Dr. Medgar Roberts, PANA validator and access faculty at the College of Doctoral Studies for the University of Phoenix, and communication major at St. Xavier University, Brian Rica.
Help. Spanish. You're taking 12th grade calculus?
Yeah, I like math.
Ew, why?
Because it's the same in every country.
It's beautiful.
Entertainment Education, the podcast, an 8-part series where host Alan Babiarz Lira will take you through the journey of how entertainment can educate and create social change.
Oh yes, the past can hurt. But the way I see it, you can either run from it or learn from it.
Hello, 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 listeners. Welcome back to Entertainment Education, Episode 5, Beep, Bop, Boop. No, that's not R2-D2. That is my really bad impression of video games. We are talking about video games this episode and how we can learn things from them. And I got two interesting, fun, creative guests that I am excited to talk about for this episode. First of all, I would like to welcome Dr. Medgar Roberts. He is from the University of Phoenix, and he is a panel validator and access faculty at the College of Doctoral Studies over there. And he was referred to me by a dear colleague and mentor of mine, Dr. Karen Johnson. So thank you, Dr. Johnson, if you're listening. And also joining us this evening is Brian Rica, a communication major from St. Xavier University, who does so much with the media production stuff at the college between writing the newspaper and the radio and podcasting and all that other fun stuff. So welcome to you both. I'm excited to have you both.
Yeah, thanks. Happy to be here.
Yes, excited.
Thank you, guys. Let's just jump in. I like to go back. I like to find out where it all began. So, Medgar, I'll start with you. Where did your love and passion for video games begin? And how did you let it evolve into part of your researching career now?
See, you're about to make me date myself because, I mean, it started a long time ago. I don't know if anybody even remembers the Magnavox Odyssey.
Yes,
came out
yes,
about yes. 1976, sometime around there. I had one of those where you can only like play Pong, or Breakout was too new for it. And then when I turned 9, I think, I finally talked my dad into letting me get an Atari 2600 and loved it. You know, the whole thing with the cartridges and having to blow in them in order to make it stick and all that. I may have had 80 games by the time I got finished playing that system. And then I went to the Intellivision, and then I went to the Atari 5200. At some point in there, I started playing computer games. I got a TRS-80 color computer. So I started programming on that and playing games on that. You know, back when you had to like put the cassette tape in and put it to that particular spot on the tape and load the game over that time. And if something happened, you had to rewind back, and you had all these little time markers for where you were going to have it. I was the first kid on the block to get a 5 1/4 inch floppy drive, and then the 3.5 inch drive. And then at some point, I switched over and consoles became a bigger deal. I got the newest Atari, and then Nintendo came in. I've had the SNES, the Game Boy, the GameCube. I just got my Switch 2. It's sitting right here in my hot little hands. But then I also had the original Xbox, and I've had every Xbox, every iteration of the Xbox. The only system that I haven't gotten, I know I'm probably going to get flamed for this, is I've never owned a PlayStation. That's the only game system I've never owned. I've played it. I have nothing against it. It's just not been the ecosystem that I got myself into. But computer games, Xbox, and Nintendo. Those have been my loves. In terms of how it came into teaching, I guess it's really a matter of your passions tend to unite. I mean, the main way that it came to me is like when you're trying to connect with boys in your class, you talk about the things that they're interested in. And when they found out that I was a gamer, it, naturally that conversation would become a part of what was going on. But then when I started in the doctoral program, my original plan for my dissertation was to find out if there was a correlation between students playing video games and standardized test scores. My hypothesis was that because there's so much problem solving that goes into gaming and so much thought about leveling up and the study that goes along with it, that students who play video games would naturally be better at standardized testing because they were going to have those logical thinking processes to become a part of it. I did not ultimately end up writing in that vein, but it is an area that I've been doing some research on just because I'm still interested in it and I want to do some scholarship around it, but not anything that's official, just me playing with my passions and putting the two things that I love together, education and gaming.
That leads me into actually a really good transition into a question that I was going to ask Brian. So Brian, you're kind of on the opposite end. You're just starting your academic journey relatively. I know you're getting ready to graduate soon, but you know, you're relatively young in your academic journey. How do you use video games? Do you use them academically at all to release stress? Have you used games in class at all? How have you done that?
I think ultimately that it's been more of a stress relief, but more so it's also been something that I would do on my free time. My first console that I can remember was a Nintendo DSi XL. And I recently found that. And over the years, I've collected countless consoles, but more so it's been something that I've utilized in a sense of wasting time and releasing or relieving stress, especially in college, trying to balance, you know, school and working. It's been very difficult to find times to meet up with my friends. It's been very difficult, you know, because everybody's got a different schedule. But the one thing that I've noticed that we all have in common is we all have PlayStations and we all have Nintendo Switches, and you know, we utilize the party feature. And you know, when someone's not in town, they're at, you know, their cousin's house or whatever, we just hop on a FaceTime call or a PlayStation party, and it's like we're hanging out virtually.
Well, you know, Medgar, who just showed us, well, for our listeners, he just held up his Nintendo Switch and showed us his new Nintendo Switch. But I know for a fact you told me you're traveling, so to take that with you, and, yes. And does that allow you to keep in touch with others, as Brian was mentioning there?
It does. When you're in a place that has internet, it does have a chat feature, and it's one of the new things that the Switch 2 has done that's kind of differentiated the platform. But I was smiling while Brian was talking because my son is 27 years old, and his sole interaction with his friends is they have a game night that they've set up, where they get together and they game online and talk into all the wee hours of the night, which is, you know, it's a completely different thing for me. It wasn't even a possibility when I was a kid. And even as a young adult, if you wanted to game together, you had to sit on a couch together. And just having that ability to stay in touch with people and really stay connected with people that are close to you, even though they're far away, I think is one of the things that makes video gaming in the current situation a very unique and alluring opportunity for young people.
Yeah, jumping in
and
there,
old people.
But jumping in during the early days of COVID-19, practically PlayStation was all I had. My friend, obviously, I couldn't go outside and go hang out by a friend's house. And we got very lucky that we all had the same brand of video games, because really the only interaction we had besides texting was we would just sit on PlayStation parties for hours on end, just talking about our lives. That was every aspect of our communication with one another. because we couldn't have that, physical connection.
You mentioned something, Brian. In episode two this season, we talked about fandom and nostalgia. Before I move on, Megger, I do have another question for you. But Brian, when you found that system that you used to play on as a child, what emotions did that bring up for you?
Intrigue, because the first thing I did when I found it was there was that little camera app that had on there. And I went in and I found just hundreds of selfies of myself when I was 5 years old with all these different filters. And I saw so many pictures of just family members, dead and alive. And I was like, wow, this is a time capsule.
That is so interesting. I love that.
I had a very similar experience with my sons because when they were little, that was one of the things that we did to for that was one of the ways that we bonded. They were too little to, so the our game that we played was Munch's Odyssey. We loved that game. And we got together and the three of us would play it. I'd hand one of them the controller and they'd play it until they couldn't get past something. They'd hand it to me and I'd play it back, hand it back to them. And so the three of us would sit around the Xbox playing Munch's Odyssey, and it was, that was our bonding time as a family when they were little, when they were like 5 and 6. And so, like, we go back, and my wife will bring out pictures of the three of us just sitting around the TV on the floor because we would prefer not to be on the sofa. And there's just so much nostalgia around that. That's why I've not gotten rid of any of my consoles. I have them all displayed in my office, like every last one of them.
Really?
Oh,
You're
yeah.
gonna have to send me pictures and I'll put them on our social media for our listeners to go check out because that would be
Okay.
really cool.
Yeah, it's like a museum in my house, my poor wife.
I love it. That almost leads me into my next question. You said that you were playing with your children, your sons, and that created quality bonding time together. But do you think that video game companies can effectively combine entertainment and education to create something that your children at the time could play and learn an effective life lesson or something like that without sacrificing player engagement?
I believe they can without a doubt, and I have proof of it. The school where I work now, so I also am an assistant principal at a high school. So I have my feet in both worlds, both in the higher education world and in the K-12 education. And we have a digital, what is it? Digital, I can't remember what her title is, but the for Algebra 1, it was toward the end of the year. There wasn't an awful lot that the kids really wanted to do. So she got together with ChatGPT and actually developed a math game. It was more of an escape room, but it was digitally created where the kids had to use the clues and use the math in order to get through the system, the series of challenges that went around math. And everybody talks about Oregon Trail, right? Oregon Trail and how big a deal it was when I was in school, and I think it kind of came back through. I think that one of the issues that we have, and one of my initial thoughts for going into, because my actual degree is educational technology, that's what my doctorate is. What I really wanted to do was two things. One, I wanted to try to do something to forecast online education coming into being. I had no idea when I started in 2009 it was going to be as big a deal as it ended up being. But then also to try to find a way for educational software to get better, because educational software as it stands right now is not very good, both from the administrative side for teachers and grade books and all of that, but then also looking at what you can do with educational software in classes. The fact that we haven't gamified some of these classes, especially in math and science, and made them more engaging for kids is, I believe, a missed opportunity because the technology is definitely there. The issue is that I'm not seeing that there is an impetus from the entertainment complex to really get into that and use that as part of their income streams. It's all about the entertainment side, and they don't ever really work on the education side. But I think it's there. I think that we can create some quality software that's not only going to make our kids smarter, but it's going to entertain them through school, because that's the biggest thing. You talk to almost any teacher, they're going to tell you that discipline is an issue. They're going to tell you that engagement is an issue. And with the availability of computers and with the availability of the programming and just how good the technology has gotten now, there's absolutely no excuse for why we haven't done more in that space.
I completely agree. I am a firm believer of entertainment education within our classroom, and it's an area of research that I'm trying to expand and explore a little bit more as I go through. You know, I'm a huge Disney fan, and that's a huge market that we can bring into the classroom. Brian, thinking of a giant fandom like Disney or Marvel, and Megger did a really great job showing that lack of, you know, video games in the classroom and education where we need it. Do you think partnering with these big fandoms would help create these games and teach social change?
I would say yes, and there's a very specific reason why. As you've seen, probably over the last 10-ish years now, there was such a thing, and still is, it is called Minecraft Education Mode. I'm not familiar with it myself, but I have heard of it, and I know people who have played it before. Like I said, I'm not really familiar with it, but there's other different games that are out there that essentially teach you real-life skills, such as, and this is going to be a completely strange option in my opinion, you never would have thought that Call of Duty, a game about violence, would teach you real life skills such as teamwork, trying to complete your objectives on time and the correct way without any problems getting in the way. And then on top of that, you also, and I sound crazy for saying this, I never understood what it meant when someone would say, look out, 10 o'clock. All that sense of direction, that is something that I've learned over the years from playing video games. A character shouts something and you wonder, huh, what does that mean? And you end up looking it up and you end up finding out something new every time you play.
You know, and I want to add to that, Brian, because I had forgotten about it. 2000, 1998, 2000, around that time, I was teaching a summer camp, and it was actually a Star Wars summer camp that I did with middle school boys between the ages of between 6th and 8th grade. And so everything that I did for the summer enrichment for them was around Star Wars. But what I was doing is I was pulling like different pieces of the movies and using that to teach literary stuff. I was using different pieces of the science and talking about math and all of that. But one of the places that we also spent a lot of time, and I can't remember if it was KOTOR or if it was Battlefront, or it was one of those video games where you're battling with lightsabers and blasters and all that. And that was a big part of our camp, but it was not just talking about, you know, the time playing, but they also talked about like teamwork skills. Like they would write tutorials for how to do certain things, how to get certain tools. They would, and that was one of the ways that I was teaching them communication. I was teaching them strategic thinking. I was teaching them, I even taught them some military history based on some of that, because like there are actual military tactics that go into that. And so it was a really interesting thing that was where I was using a fandom, right? Because the kids were all like gaga over Star Wars. This was when Phantom Menace came out, was one of the years that I was teaching that. And it translated the video games and the fandom translated into that summer school experience. It was really cool.
Well, you actually brought me to another fantastic transition. So you just keep reading my mind. Thank you so much. I'm just going to make you the permanent co-host of my podcast because, you know, you're just taking it and running with it. But, I wanted to talk about now more traditional forms of media like film and Star Wars and these great medias that we see, cartoons and video games. Do you think that video games differ from these traditional medias when it comes to teaching people and storytelling?
I will say this, and not because I saw this movie last night, but James Gunn's Superman, I saw that last night. It was a movie, I'm not going to say anything, but it just makes you have hope for humanity. And it's based off of the ideals of the character Superman. Superman is just the man who, you know, does what is right for good reasons. He has logic and he doesn't want anyone to suffer. And translating that to video games, There are video games set in multiple fandoms where there's characters like Luke Skywalker or Spider-Man. They all demonstrate their morals in different ways, and it's more so humanizing. I mean, you'd think that sometimes there's these NPCs walking around in video games, but more so they're realistic based on their reactions to the many things that are happening all around them.
Well, I am going to say this, Brian. You talked to me into going to see that movie because I wasn't going to go see it because I just don't think that guy looks like Superman. I think Chris Reeves is Superman. I think, oh goodness, I forgot his name, Henry Cavill. I think that's Superman. But now I'm going to have to see it because now I'm curious. I'm one of those people who believes that you can use anything to teach anything, and I've done that throughout my career as a piece of my teaching. But I do think that there is something different about video games because video games are so innately participatory. I'll give you an example. My son talked us into allowing him to play KOTOR when he was, I guess he was about 11 years old. And we just kind of kept watching his choices when he's in the game. And, you know, then leading too into Fable and Fable 2 and those games as well. And him being able to see that the choices that he was making within the game had a direct impact on who his character became. And the importance of morality and the importance of choices and all of those kinds of things. And there was a huge discussion that I kind of giggled, I probably shouldn't have, that he and my wife were having about whether he could kill these NPCs that were in the game in KOTOR, like whether that was a good idea or not, because they had things that he wanted, right? And so I feel like reading is difficult for students, not just because, I mean, there's a whole different part of like teaching reading that becomes a part of that, right? But it requires a lot more work on that side from the standpoint of the reader to imagine all of these situations themselves and to figure out what the characters sound like and what the scenes look like. So then you take that to the next step and you look at movies, right? Movies are a lot less participatory because they're giving you the scenery, they're giving you the characters, and sometimes they don't look like they did in the books, but they're giving you that vision of them. Well, when you throw a video game on top of it, and especially with some of the hyper-realism that video games can have now, or you know, when they go the other way and go into a more like drawn situation like they do with, oh, what is the name of it? The one where the game, the new game, the Xbox, it's not new, it's like 3 years old, where they're using scripts and scrolls and it's kind of hand-drawn. But it gives your gamer the ability to make decisions and to actively participate in what's going on, which completely changes the situation. It's you don't know when you give your students something to read whether they're actually reading it or not. You don't necessarily know when you give them a movie whether they're actually watching the movie or not, because a lot of our students don't really know how to watch movies. They don't know what they're looking for. But when they're gaming, you can, there's a lot more participation that has to take place. You can't pretend to play a game. It just doesn't work that way. You're either playing the game or you're not. It's not the same way when you're talking about movies, and it's definitely not the same way when you're talking about reading. Now, that being said, I don't think that any of those things should go away. I was an English teacher for 25 years, so I really believe that reading is extremely important and that that's one of the fundamental skills that we should have. And I also believe in the power of movies and movie making, but I think that gaming is one of those areas where we have an opportunity to do something really special that we haven't fully embraced and used in the way that we could.
You know, you bring up a couple of really good important facts there. If you can't read, you can't read, you can't fake it. Same thing with gaming. If you can't, I'm not great at video gaming. I can't fake it. I can make my way through, but I definitely can't fake it. Same thing for the educational side, you know. If you struggle in reading, it's the practice that's what's going to make it better. Just like any kind of anything that we do in everyday life, the more we do it, the better we become, obviously.
Well, and I think too,
Brian.
it matters what the kind of game he is too. You know, I'm terrible at Call of Duty. I'll die more than I'll ever contribute to the team. But there are games that you play that don't require you to have that manual dexterity side. And I think everybody thinks about the manual dexterity as a part of it when it doesn't necessarily have to be. You know, I video game on my computer, on my phone all the time, right? I love Disney Emoji Blitz. I think it's great. I can get in, play a game, and get out. But this, and the same thing is true when you start talking about narrative games and things like that. Like, I think those are areas that we have available to us as educators that can help us explore really important concepts and really important ideals and skills that we've not gotten an opportunity to hook into.
You know, one of the things that we kind of have been dancing around a little bit, all three of us in our conversation. We've mentioned the communication aspect, but there's also a critical thinking aspect and decision-making aspect to all of this. I, as you were saying, there are other ways that we could express ourselves in video games. And you're right, I kill in Disney Dreamlight Valley. Let me tell you, I'm a wit. I've gone through and I'm great. But that's because I can do decision. I've got critical thinking and decision-making skills, which is different than a first-person shooter Call of Duty kind of thing. I agree with you. I couldn't do anything to help a team, right? Even in real life, if we're going paintballing, no, forget it. I'm the first one hit. But you find what your forte is and bring it to you and bring it you those skills to what you have is what I think about that. Brian, I'm going to jump back to you for a second here. What do you think that things like virtual reality and augmented reality, what do you think they're going to do for the video game industry? Do you think it's going to be make it more immersive in the future? Because I could see almost like a driver's ed video game in a virtual reality headset, kind of deal. What do you think?
So this reminds me of a video of a guy at a restaurant, literally the day of the release of the Apple Vision Pro. He was playing some game where he smashes plates or something, and you could see through the goggles what exactly was happening. And he's sitting in a restaurant, and he quite literally breaks one of the plates in front of him, and he realizes that it was not fake. And so I think that virtual reality is going to make things a little rough for video gaming, well, for the industry in general, because there's reality like the Apple Vision Pro that essentially augments your own reality. And then there's the Meta Quest that you're putting on this goggle that blocks out your environment and puts you in this fake environment. And it reminds me because I had a Oculus Quest, whatever you want to call it, I had one. And I would play this game called Blade and Sorcery. It was very helpful because it showed you your own boundary. So you could see exactly how far you have to move until you hit a wall. And not only was it fun, but it was revolutionary. I downloaded these mods for Star Wars, which really suits me, and it was just the most amazing thing being able to feel in the controllers the vibrations and haptics as I was reaching out and trying to force pull my lightsaber. And you feel it go into your hand, you feel the ignition, and it's got the surround sound 360 degrees. You hear everything. You hear when someone's walking behind you, ready to strike you down. It's just this incredible, revolutionary way to game, but I think that the Apple Vision Pro is not the way to go. I don't want to be just sitting in my room here and then all of a sudden the world around me just changes. Did you know that you can create a virtual movie theater essentially in the Apple Vision Pro? You can be sitting down anywhere you want and you could set a virtual background that changes the room around you. You could sit on Tatooine and that's it sounds amazing, but if I'm somewhere that's not someplace where I should be doing that, then I should not be doing that.
Well, I could see that, and then I could see, maybe falling asleep and waking up, and you're like, wait, where am I?
I literally saw a video of that earlier. A guy fell asleep while playing Minecraft VR and woke up and freaked out for a minute.
I feel for some plates and walls that are going to be breaking.
I have a Meta Quest 3, and I wanted an Apple Vision Pro. It's just the price was prohibitive. But I think the future of it is really somewhere in between. I think that really the Meta glasses are probably going to be closer to where we're going to go where that's concerned. Because I agree, like I don't use my I don't use my MetaQuest as much as I would like to, because I want to be able to be involved in the things that are going on in my home. And having this huge apparatus on my face, even if I'm using pass-through mode, just feels like I'm separating myself from the other people in the room. That being said, from an educational standpoint, there is an amazing opportunity there because I can't afford to take my kids to Rome to go see the Colosseum. I can't afford to take them to the Vatican. I can't afford to take them to the Basilica. I can't afford to take them to Chicago. I can't afford to do that on a regular basis. But if there are things that I want them to see and things that I want them to investigate, and having the ability in a physics class to be able to show them like the physics of an F1 car, I think having VR and have it be as powerful as it is now is really phenomenal. I was very skeptical of it myself until I was walking around Best Buy, I grabbed one of the three, and I put my head in. I can't remember the name of the game, but it was kind of a God of War kind of thing that the game was. And I'm going, oh my God, I'm there. I have to have one of these. There are things that you can do if when you have those virtual tours. There are things you can do when you have those virtual environments that you can show and have people understand from a spatial perspective that you wouldn't be able to do without having that technology. And so I do believe that is a possibility. Now, the flip side to that is always going to be in education money, right? Each one of those units, I think the lowest price you can get a decent MetaQuest headset for is about $300, all the way up to almost $4,000 to get an Apple Vision Pro. Schools just don't have that kind of money. And you also don't have a whole lot of teachers. That becomes a piece of it too. You don't have a whole lot of teachers who know that technology either, which I think also goes into why we don't see more gaming in schools. Most of our teachers are not video gamers. They just aren't. You just look at the demographics of who most of our teachers are, and they don't, if they're going to play games, they're going to play casual games on their phone. They're not familiar with the landscape of what these more advanced technologies can do. It's not their interest, right? A lot of it is going to depend upon whether we put the resources into training teachers, whether we put the resources into making sure that the technology stays up to date, and whether we put the resources into developing technology and software that's going to drive these experiences for students and for teachers and make the job easier for both. As long as we don't do that, it's not going to go anywhere. But that's the key. Like, that's always going to be the key. Are we willing to buy it? Are we willing to develop for it? And are we willing to train on it? And without those three things, whether you're talking about video games or whether you're talking about VR or whether you're talking about anything in education, that's going to be your line of demarcation.
Sometimes I think I feel I live in my own little naive world because, I didn't think of things like, oh yeah, maybe other people don't video game. Maybe other people don't play games. This isn't their reality. This isn't their normal day-to-day kind of operation that other people do in training, as we know, in not only higher ed, but in the K-12, is we're just lacking resources, period. Not just training, but we're just lacking resources 1,000%. So I
Well, and let me add
appreciate.
a little bit to that. I was an elementary school principal, and in my building, I had 110 employees, 110 people, adult people that worked in that building with me. There were two men. I was one of them.
I think you're a little
Who plays video
outnumbered.
games? I was a little
Predominantly
outnumbered.
men, yeah.
But who plays video games? Predominantly men. So then, if you take that and do the macro view for what we've got in K-12 education, it's something like 70% women. I haven't looked at those statistics recently, but the last time I looked, it was easily 70% women. And I think that's going to change as things as we grow because I think video games have become more saturated around us. So I think that there are a lot more women who play games in like Gen Z than ever existed, definitely among, Gen X with me and maybe even millennials. So that may change, but as it stands, the predominant form of entertainment for the predominant group of people who teach our children in K-12 education is not video games. So they're not thinking in terms of how they can use those to improve education.
Medgar, you meant again, you mentioned just this a little bit. Narration and storytelling is important, not only in video games, but all forms of media, TV shows, movies, etc. So, how do the different types of genres, the video game genres themselves, kind of lend to these different types of educational storytelling that we could use today?
I don't think that they intentionally do, and I think that's part of the issue. So, like, just backing up and talking about Oregon Trail, right? Oregon Trail is set up to be a narrative, and it's set up to teach. Here's the story of what happened when these people decided to move out and establish the Oregon Territory, and the things that could happen to them. And you're kind of creating your own story as that goes on, with like real consequences for what's happening, right? You can do the same thing with Call of Duty. There's a story. There is a narrative line in the first person version of Call of Duty, and you can play that line through. But if you're doing the battles, that's not necessarily the most important thing. Like, the story that's being told really is the story of the skills and the decisions that are being made by the characters within that game, which is fundamentally different from also what's happening with a game like Animal Crossing, right? You're developing your own land, you're developing your own identity, Roller Coaster Tycoon, Catan, Civilization 6, or any of the Civilization games, right? All of those things, there is a narrative that is a part of it, but that narrative comes out of the world that the game is attempting to develop necessarily. But if we are building our software around the concept of a narrative that has an educational arc to it, right? Because the same thing is true. Like, when you start looking at, I'm going to get real education nerdy for just a second if I can do that.
Please
When you're
do.
putting a lesson together, when you're putting a lesson together, a lesson has the same story arc that you have whenever you're putting a movie together, right? You have your exposition, you have your rising action, you have your climax, you have your falling action, and your resolution, denouement. The same thing happens when you're putting a lesson together, right? You should have some front loading that's happening with the students. This is what we're doing. This is what we're going to learn. These are the things that you're going to be able to do when you get done. Then you get into the meat of what you're building, giving them the skills, giving them the resources, giving them the background for whatever it is happening. Then at some point, you're going to have some kind of an assignment, either a formative assessment or a summative assessment, that is going to make them, the main character of the lesson, right, have to make a decision on what they're going to do for that learning. That then goes into your falling action, and in the most boring cases, that's just going to be like a 100-question multiple choice test, right? Of you proving that you know the information. But in the case of like putting a project together, working with your team, putting together a PowerPoint, putting together an experience for the class, that's also a falling action that happens. And then you have your resolution denouement, which is the evaluation of that assignment, right? In the course of all of that, there are subplots that are going on. There are certain things that you are learning that all becomes a part of that. Whenever you're looking at teaching, automatically should, if it is a well-designed lesson, have a narrative arc that is a part of that. Then the same thing is going to be true with a video gaming experience, right? It's got to have that arc. You've got to teach your players how to play. You've got to give them a reason to want to play. You've got to give them the things that they have to do. You've got to give them a challenge that they have to solve. You've got to give them an opportunity to succeed or fail. And then you have to give them that payoff for whatever it is that they end up getting. All of that happens. So you can always make the argument that everything that we're doing is about narration. You can make that argument if without doing an awful lot of work that way. But I think because we don't explicitly think about it in those terms, because we're not explicitly breaking down those experiences in a way that makes it meaningful for people to do these things, it sometimes gets lost in translation, if that makes sense. And I hope I answered the question. I feel like I kind of went off the subject a little bit, but.
No, absolutely not. That was fantastic, and it's also a, you think of how far the attention span goes, not only in class, but also while you're playing a game. While you're playing a game, if your attention span is over with, you can fortunately press that off button and you're good. You're in class, you're listening to this lecture, you're going up, you're getting your assignment, and then you start to go down, but you can't turn off the professor.
Well,
You can't
class is
really
90
keep
minutes every day. I mean,
exactly.
in a classroom situation, class is 90 minutes every day. You have to survive that time regardless. And I'm saying survive because I've been in some classrooms where that's been true.
Absolutely. Well, that'll lead into my last question here. Brian, do you feel that more professors should use video games in their classrooms?
You know what? I'm going to go two side here.
Okay, and why?
I would say that the most perfect kind of media that can be used in a classroom, there's two of them, in my opinion, film and television and music. It's all about looking deeper within lyrics, within quotes, within all these different actions. Actions have purposes. And sometimes it's also about the shot. But when it comes to video games, it's not always going to be like that. But I'm going to tell you this. There's also some very bad instances that happen in video games, especially if we're talking about online. The amount of trash talking is unnecessarily high. And I feel like everything we've talked about right now has been more so the single player or playing with friends experience. We haven't touched upon the part where you're playing with strangers. When you do that, you're entering a world of uncertainty where there's a lot of things that can happen. And I'd say that in a classroom setting is honestly very unprofessional. You never know what could happen. You never know what awful things you'll hear.
Yeah, that is another door that we haven't been able to open so far in this episode. Maybe in an expansion, I'd love to touch on that again, but there is, online bullying, not only in gaming, but all social media and all sorts of that is obviously prevalent and an issue right now. So I agree with kind of what you're saying and your perspective there, and I appreciate it. Unfortunately, though, we are coming to the time of our episode, coming towards the end. But before I leave, my two friends here, do you guys mind if I hit you with some rapid fire questions? Are we
Not at all. Hit
good?
me with your best shot.
All right.
Yeah,
These
I'm game.
are all going to be game related somehow. Okay? Somehow game
Okay.
related. Okay. Just give me your first thoughts. Okay? Medgar, I'll start with you.
Okay.
What was your favorite console so far?
My favorite console so far.
Your favorite video game console that you've
Oh,
owned?
my favorite console. Oh, that's tough. I had the most fun with my. I think I had the most fun with my Atari. I think because it was so novel and so new. Yeah, my Atari 2600. That's my favorite.
Brian, what was your favorite game growing up?
Super Mario Sluggers, Nintendo Wii.
Medgar, if you could create your own game about anything, what would the plot line be about?
Mean, the plot lines are always somebody with a special talent contributes something to the world that makes the world a better place. I can't come up with anything better than that.
I love that. That is a great description. Brian, if you could put yourself in any game franchise, what would it be?
That's a good question. I would definitely say Star Wars Battlefront. Yes.
Ah, yes.
Yes, my man.
I'm going to
My
tell
man.
you, I'm going to tell you this. I want to be flying in Republic ship. I don't want to do anything else. I just want to fly.
I love it.
Nice.
Medgar, digital video games or physical video games?
You know, there's a lot of debate about that around the Switch 2 these days.
I
I'm that's not a quick question, man. That's like a
know. Go with your gut. Go with your gut.
I like the convenience of being able to play any game I want to whenever I want to digitally, but I don't like the impermanence of it. So that's the physical and the collector in me. But yeah, I mean, I'm doing most of my games on my Switch 2. I'm doing most of my games digital unless the whole game is on the physical key card, the physical card. And then I'm doing that if I can.
So we'll go with the best of both worlds. How about that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, digital is, I just, the old guy in me, like I want the stuff. I want it in my hand, you know?
I
But I
hear
don't
you.
know.
I hear you. All right, Brian, this one's very you, and it's our last question of the day. Who is your favorite Wreck-It Ralph character?
My favorite Wreck-It Ralph character?
I know
Goodness.
mine.
Oh, go for it, Megger.
Penelope.
You gotta love Penelope.
Penelope. Yeah, Penelope's my favorite. Yeah.
You know what? I'm gonna go with an iconic one because this is a cameo, Sonic the Hedgehog.
There you
Oh,
go. Nice. Well
that
done, sir.
was, they got the original voice actor for him too.
Yeah, that's good. That was well played, sir. Played.
Yes. Thank you both of you for joining me today. I had a fun time with this conversation. I hope that you guys enjoy being here with us today. To the listeners out there are still three more episodes coming this season. Episode six is going to talk about, legacy media, TV, news, newspaper. Episode seven is going to talk about literature and narratives. And then episode eight, we end the season just like I did last season. Talking about Disney, my favorite thing. Medgar, Brian, thank you again so much for joining me today. I really appreciated both of you being here with me. Please, you are welcome back anytime. Please join me again if you will.
Thank you. And let me apologize too for all the beeping behind those of you guys that are hearing it. I'm in a restaurant and the door keeps opening and closing. So that's what all the dinging is, if you figured that out.
Luckily, it did not come through too prominently, so I think we're good. I think our listeners are going to
Good.
be cool. So, thank you again, and as my pal Mickey Mouse says, we'll see you real soon.